1 Samuel chapter 5, let's go ahead and read it together. Now the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set him in his place again. It's almost humorous. But when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God." And they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they said, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." And they brought the ark of Israel around. After they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. And he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. And as the ark of God came to Ekron, the Ekronites cried out, saying, "They have brought the ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." They sent, therefore, and gathered all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of God of Israel and let it return to its own place so that it will not kill us and our people." For there was a deadly confusion throughout the city. The hand of God was very heavy there. And the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So here we see the capture of the ark. Now, what happens after the capture of the ark? We're going to be following that a little bit on our map here for just a couple of moments. In the first few chapters, we've seen God fulfilling his prophecy of judgment against the household of Eli. We've also seen that Israel's superstitious use of the ark got them into trouble. Remember, it was their lucky rabbit's foot. We just bring it into battle and everything's going to be great. You know, it's our magical talisman we're going to bring with us. And that's how they treated the ark of God. And they were defeated by the Philistines twice. Then there was further trouble beyond just the death of Eli and his sons, because the ark of God was captured by the Philistines. So let's look at that this morning. Remember, their first encounter was between Aphek and Ebenezer, and there was a clash between the Israelites and the Philistines. The first battle, the first clash, 4,000 troops were lost. Then on the second one, 30,000 were lost. So Israel did not do well here. This is a problem. They should have been waking up to what was going on, but unfortunately they did not. Then the ark was moved from Shiloh near the battle with the Philistines, captured by the Philistines at Ebenezer. So here it was in Shiloh. That's where they worshipped at the time. It was not the tabernacle was not in Jerusalem at this time. It was in Shiloh for many, many years. And notice they moved it to approximately the area there. And when they came to Ebenezer, apparently, the Philistines captured the ark. So now it's the Philistines' ark at this time. And then following the capture of the ark, it was taken to Ashdod. This is what we were reading about a couple of minutes ago. So the area of the battle here, it was taken to Ashdod. And then as we'll continue to go even ahead of our story here. Then according to chapter 5, verses 8 and 9, the ark was moved from Ashdod to Gath. As you know, anyone who was born in Gath? Can you think of anyone who was born in Gath? Famous biblical character? Kind of a big guy. Goliath, Goliath of Gath. He was from the city of Gath. Goliath was some big dudes. They grew there, and then from Gath to Ekron, the ark was moved. Then chapter 5, verse 10 through chapter 6 and verse 9. And obviously, we're not going to get into chapter 6. All right, if it will change, that would be nice. All right, I wonder if my battery just went all of a sudden. All right, that was the last one there. I don't know why it didn't shut off. All right, well, we'll see it from there. And not sure what's going on with that, but I'll take a look at it later. All right, so let's follow the outline then today, okay? We saw, first of all, from Ebenezer to Ashdod, and that was actually verses 1 through 7. In fact, let's go back. We could look at the map again if it's going to respond to me. Maybe it will not. And I'll just, all right. All right, maybe. All right, there we go. All right, there's where it was. We saw that there already, and then it went from Ebenezer to Ashdod. So we'll look at the first movement of it. Yes, I think my battery's getting low on this. It's not responding. All right, there we go. All right, so that's what we see in verses 1 through 7. Let's look at that. First of all, it says in verse 1, now the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Now, the city was actually 3 miles, if you look at it. It's right near the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is there on the west there, just west of the city. It's about 30 miles southwest of Ebenezer, 3 miles from the Mediterranean. And it appears to have been a very important commercial center. Usually commercial centers, particularly in the ancient world, were near bodies of water. And so this was a very important commercial center. The city also contained a temple. And this temple was to the national deity of the Philistines, which was Dagon, which we see in this whole story that I read. And then verse 2, then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it to the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. All right? So they took it into the house, or the temple of Dagon. The God's name probably comes from the Hebrew word for grain. The New International Dictionary of Old Testament Theology and Exegesis mentions that Dagon, quote, was a god worshipped in Mesopotamia since at least the 3rd millennium B.C., portrayed as a god of fertility, especially of grain. Baal was later associated with his functions, and Baal is thus described in Ugar as the son of Dagon. So there's a relationship there to Dagon, Dagon of Baal. According to chapters 5 and 6, the Philistines worshiped Dagon, and it was quite a sophisticated religious system. There was a temple, as we see. There was a priesthood, chapter 6 and verse 2. There were diviners or omen readers, chapter 6 and verse 2. There was some concept of an offering, chapter 6, verses 3 and 4. So the Ark of God is brought into the temple of their god of fertility as a trophy of victory. Because when you, you know, my God's bigger than your God is kind of the idea. So they saw that box. They saw the Ark of the Covenant as being the god, the idol of Israel. And so they set that idol next to their idol, in essence saying, our God is better than your God. We have defeated your God. He is stronger than your God is. So it's brought into that temple, and it's set up next to Dagon as the superior one. And then verse 3, notice, when the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, and they took Dagon and set him in his place again. Hey guys, your God fell over. I mean, think about that. Your God just fell over. We're in the temple and we saw that God fell over. Not only was he toppled over, he was in a posture of defeat and worship before the ark, showing that that God is superior to any idol. No doubt this was a large image. It's not easily knocked over. It wasn't some little, tiny thing that you could set on your desk or something. This was a large idol in the temple. And so to knock this thing over, it probably would have taken an earthquake. I'm sure they couldn't explain it. So how disturbing this must have been to the Philistines. And really how silly this is. I mean, your God is being knocked over. How absolutely foolish all of this is. And how ironic the next part of the verse is. So they took Dagon and set him up in his place again. Think about this. Pardon me, I have to go reposition my God. Excuse me, I have to go back into the temple and set my God back up again because he fell down. Well, if he's a God, I mean, you know the obvious question there, right? If he's a God, why would he fall down? Couldn't he do it himself? If he's that popular or that powerful, surely he could do that all by himself. It's just absurd. Their supposedly powerful deity whom they worshipped, get this, they worshipped him, had to be picked up and put back into his place by humans. So who's the superior one? Couldn't a God act on his own? Couldn't he do it all by himself? Look at Isaiah 46, 6 and 7. Isaiah 46, 6 and 7. Great chapter. Isaiah 46, in verses 6 and 7. Let's begin with verse 5. To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me? That we would be alike. Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale, hire a goldsmith, and he makes it into a god. They bow down, indeed they worship it. They lift it upon the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place and it stands there. It does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer, it cannot deliver him from his distress. So here in Isaiah, the absurdity of all of this is being brought across too. You know, they set the God into place. They manufacture him. They form him and then they set him up into place and he can't answer you. He can't talk to you. But yet they worship this thing. And so in Isaiah, the same kind of absurdity is brought across in chapter 46. And all of this demonstrates the inferiority of Dagon to Yahweh, to God, to the true God. And we notice now in verse 4, but when they arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord, Yahweh, and the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Well, it gets worse. They go, set their God back up, probably wondering, how could it have fallen like this? Then they come the next day, he's fallen again. And this time, no head and palms of his hands are cut off. Now think about this. Think about how absurd this is. Early the next morning, not only is Dagon found in a worshipful position once again before the ark, but now his head and his hands are cut off. This seems strange, the idea of the head and the hands cut off, but in ancient culture, they well knew what this meant. In this time, severed heads, remember David cut off Goliath's head, okay? But in this time, a severed head and hands, and Judges 8 and verse 6 talks about that, they were battlefield trophies that helped in establishing a correct body count. So heads and hands were normally, many times, they were cut off on the battlefield to establish how many people were killed. And Yahweh had defeated Dagon in his own temple. Notice, too, that the head and hands of Dagon were cut off on the threshold of the temple. And that leads us to the next verse. And it's absurd. It's equally absurd. Verse 5, therefore neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Do you see the humor in this? It didn't end their worship of Dagon. I mean, wouldn't you begin to think if you had a god that fell before the true God, wouldn't you say, you know, maybe this is a false god? In fact, now his head's gone. You now have a headless god and one without the hands. Wouldn't that kind of wake you up and you'd say, you know what, maybe this is a false god, you know? Obviously, Yahweh's a lot more powerful than we claim this god is, so it doesn't make... But that isn't what they did. They just adapted their superstitious ritual to suit the condition of the time. How stupid. Think about it. So now they've got another superstitious ritual in their worship practice. Now they don't step on the threshold. The threshold was now sacred for coming into contact with Dagon's head and hands. How stupid. How foolish. Zephaniah chapter 1 verse 9, and I will punish on that day all who leap on the temple threshold, who fill the house of their Lord with violence and deceit. Idolatry. You know, and we look at this and we can see the absurdity of it. We can see how foolish it is, how stupid it is. But you know, the Bible tells us that there's more to idolatry than just fashioning an image and bowing before that image. Now, we do have modern idolatry. You go into some Hindu places and you will see false gods. They worship false gods. They have many false gods, in fact, that they worship. Hindus do. If you go into the Roman Catholic Church, what do? They bow before statues. They genuflect. They cross themselves. They light candles to pictures. They have pagan things and that happen, like Mary is weeping and just all kinds of other bizarre things. They worship Jesus on a tortilla. Yes. Crazy stuff. So we look at this and we say, oh, the Philistines, they're so foolish. But our culture is too. Our culture is just as wicked. We're just as steeped in idolatry. And then add to that Ephesians 5:5 and Colossians 3:5, which says that covetousness is tantamount to idolatry. Same thing. Why? Because I am taking something and making it my God with covetousness. Something is more important than God. When I make something more important than God, it becomes an idol. And it's just as foolish. It's just as foolish. It's just as absurd to depend on the idols that we have today. Some people worship the idol of riches. Some people covet riches. And that is idolatry. Some people place time before God. I've got to have my time. I've got to do my things. Many things are placed before God in our society today, even by Christians, and that is modern idolatry. And let me ask you a question. Are you going to take those things with you when you die? I remember when I was in Michigan, one of the real popular things during the summer, people went to cottages. And some people every weekend would go to their cottage. They might be at church in the wintertime, but and hit mess usually. But during the summer, we have to open our cottage, and we live at our cottage up there. And, of course, we don't worry too much about worshiping the Lord when we're there. You know, such beautiful scenery. We'll probably pray once in a while. But that cottage becomes their idol then, and it did. I knew some professing Christians that had that idol. And let me ask you a question. Are they going to take that cottage with them when they die? You know, are they going to be able to take that cottage with them? No, it's temporal, not eternal. How about the riches? People, oh, they hang on to their riches. Riches are their idolatry. Money, or their idol. Money is their idol. By the way, money can be a person's idol whether they have it or not. They could still covet to have more. And it could still be an idol. So whether you have it or not, it doesn't matter. You just aspire to it and lust over it. That's when it becomes your idol. But are you going to be able to take that with you? There's a saying in German, das Totenhemd hat keine Taschen. In other words, the shroud has no pockets. You can't stuff all your money in your shroud and take it with you to the next life. Doesn't work that way. And so it's just as foolish as these people were with their idols. Folks, we need to get rid of our idols. Little children, keep yourselves from idols, Scripture says. Verse 6. Now the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. Now notice it says the hand of the Lord. We see now a major theme that has begun now in the Ark narrative, and that is the hand of the Lord. There are 9 occurrences of this phrase in this section of 1 Samuel. Chapter 4, verse 8. Chapter 5, verse 6. Verse 7, verse 9, verse 11. Chapter 6, verse 3, verse 5, verse 9. And chapter 7 and verse 13. So it's all over this section. The hand of the Lord, showing his strength, showing his authority. Dagon's hands, remember, were cut off, showing how powerless he was. Now we see the powerful God of the universe in action with his right hand, the hand of the Lord. And notice it says he ravaged them. Literally, he brought devastation to them. And it says something here about tumors. This is a little odd. What is it in the King James? Emerods, I think it is. I used to think, well, isn't that an old lady's perfume? You know, emerod. But no, it's not what it's talking about here. It's talking about tumors. But what kind of tumor? Notice chapter 4 and verse 8. Woe to us! Who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Well, here is a plague coming upon them. I've often wondered about this disease and its connection to what is written in the next chapter. We're going to see that next too. But we find in this chapter that whatever was afflicting them was deadly. And then in chapter 6, we find that it was associated with mice. Any idea what it might be? Now, I want to handle this delicately, so I'll just read a quote from Ronald F. Youngblood, who writes of the outbreak of this same disease in verse 9. He writes this: "Thus the Lord's hand was against Gath and brought an outbreak of tumors on its inhabitants." The word, the Hebrew word for outbreak, is found only here and was apparently interpreted by the Septuagint as groin, yielding the translation tumors in the groin, a common symptom of bubonic plague associated with mice. Yes. So this is a plague that he brought upon these people. This is bubonic plague. This is serious stuff. Online Merck Manual of Medical Information writes this: the bacterium that causes plague primarily infects wild rodents such as rats, mice, squirrels, and prairie dogs. In the past, massive plague epidemics such as the Black Death in the Middle Ages killed large numbers of people. Large numbers of rodents and poor sanitation were the major factors contributing to these epidemics. Bubonic plague symptoms usually appear 2 to 5 days after exposure to the bacterium, but they can appear anytime from a few hours to 12 days later. Symptoms start suddenly with chills and a fever of up to 106 degrees Fahrenheit. The heartbeat becomes rapid and weak, and the blood pressure may drop. Swollen lymph nodes, also called buboes, appear in the groin, armpit, or neck shortly before or along with the fever. The person is likely to become restless, delirious, confused, and uncoordinated. The liver and spleen may enlarge and can be felt easily during examination. Lymph nodes may fill with pus and drain spontaneously during the second week. Get this. More than 60% of untreated people die. Most deaths occur between the third and the fifth day. This was bad. They're scared to death of what is going on. It's obvious why. You know, bubonic plague is going on. It's not like they have a great course of antibiotics to use. They're in deep trouble. Verse 7. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God." Well, they got part of it right. Yeah, God's hand was definitely on them. No question about it. But on Dagon their God. Yeah, I suppose that's true too. But Dagon is not a god at all. He's just a piece of metal and stone or whatever, however they fashioned him. They felt that God had something against this city in particular and against Dagon. But in the end, they still didn't get it. There's something even more amazing to me that they didn't get. You would think that after Dagon lay in pieces, his head gone, his palm or his hands gone, and after he could not stop the plague from ravaging them, that they would have reasoned that Dagon was a false god. But they didn't. So even after this, even after they started getting the plague, they still didn't reason that, oh, Dagon must not be real. They reasoned instead that Israel's God had it in for their God. Once again. All right. So now we move on. We saw this a minute ago in verses 8 and 9. If it will give me a change here. Verses 8 and 9, there we go. Verses 8 and 9, now we see from Ashdod to Gath in verses 8 and 9. So let's look at those two verses. Notice verse 8. So they sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" And they said, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." And they brought the ark of God of Israel around. So they're passing it from city to city. Nobody wants it in their city, we find out. Notice it says, after they brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city in very great confusion. And he smote the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So plague in that city as well. And remember, this is divine. It isn't just, well, they happened to catch plague because there were some bad rats around or whatever. God caused this to happen. They did at least recognize that. That part of it was accurate. Notice what it says here too in verse 8. They sent and gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them. Probably the five lords who were the rulers of the five ruling cities. You see, the Philistines had what we would call a pentapolis. In other words, they had five cities. We see the ark traveling around there. But they had five cities. In fact, if you look at chapter 6 in verse 17, you actually have the Pentapolis laid out for you. These are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned for a guilt offering to the Lord. One for Ashdod, okay? We've already seen that. You see it on the map. Ashdod. So that was one of the Pentapolis cities. Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. All of those were Philistine cities, the Pentapolis, are major cities. And so the lords of the cities, we might call them mayors today, maybe, or governors, whatever, would they came, according to verse 8 here, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? What are we going to do? And so notice in verse 9, they brought it around. The hand of the Lord was against the city with very great confusion. So we're going to send it to Gath. Well, guess what? Gath has problems too. Maybe if we send it away to another city, that everything will be okay. So the people, both young and old in Gath, were also struck with these buboes, with bubonic plague, with these tumors. And notice it says that the city was in confusion. The Hebrew here refers to tumult, confusion, panic. They were absolutely panicking because of what was going on. Unbelievable. And then we see our third city journey here from the with the ark, the third Philistine city, maybe. All right, there we go. And we see the third Philistine city, that was from Gath to Ekron. That goes from chapter 5, verse 10 to chapter 6 and verse 9. Of course, we won't get that far. But notice it says in verse 10, so they sent the ark of God to Ekron. So now they're passing it off to another city. And as the ark of God came to Ekron, the Ekronites cried out, they have brought the ark of God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people. So they're saying, there's going to be bubonic plague here too. You're bringing this ark around to us, he's going to kill us. He's going to destroy this whole city. Are you out of your minds? Still they do not return, but get this, still they do not return the ark of God to Israel. Still. They still haven't quite gotten it yet. They don't really want it in any of the cities. They're going to keep passing it off, but evidently they need more convincing. So they shuffled the ark off to another city about 6 miles north of Gath. The people in Ekron realized that it might not be a wise thing to have Israel's ark in their city, since death and destruction follow the ark wherever it went in Philistine territory. And they're saying, this is stupid. Don't do this to us. Verse 11, so that it, you get that? It will not kill us and our people. It, the ark. They sent all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of the Lord of the God of Israel. And let it return to its own place so that it will not kill us and our people. For there was deadly confusion throughout the city, and the hand of God was very heavy there. But notice they still looked at the ark as an idol. It was the ark of God, yes. But they still looked at it as an idol because it was the thing that was killing people. It wasn't, had nothing to do with the ark, except that they possessed the ark. It was their problem. God was judging them for stealing something that was not theirs, that represented the very presence of God. But it wasn't the ark that was killing them. God was dealing with them. God of the Israelites was judging them. And once again, same word here, deadly confusion throughout the city. The NIV translates it, for death had filled the city with panic. Everyone is in panic. So everywhere the ark goes, there is panic in the Philistine territory. God is judging them wherever this thing goes. Verse 12, last verse. And the men who did not die were smitten with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So finally, they're at their wits' end. Finally, they're at their wits' end. The men who did not die had tumors. So it was, plague was everywhere. It was incredible here. So along with panic and tumors, God slew many people in this city as well. It was a bloodbath. And finally, they're going to learn the lesson. They shouldn't have this ark. And we find in chapter 6 that they end up returning it. And we see an interesting narrative in chapter 6 about them returning the ark, and we will see that next time. Let's conclude, though, with several ideas. Number one, God is sovereign. Not Israel, not the Philistines, not Dagon could control or resist God's will. God is sovereign. And in our world today, it's not the politicians, it's not the police, it's not the pastors, it's God who is in control. It's not religious leaders, no, God is in control. There's a lot of people that think they're the ones in control. It's not the super rich, God is in control. It doesn't matter what people think. God is the one who is sovereign in our culture today, just as he was then. He hasn't changed, has he? He hasn't suddenly abdicated his throne in heaven. No, he hasn't. God is still sovereign. Number two, God is not limited by a box or a location. He is omnipresent. God is with us today. And you know the encouraging thing about God's omnipresence is when I pray to God, and by the way, when I say omnipresence, I mean that God is everywhere at once with his whole person. Let me say that again. God is everywhere at once with his whole person. We get the idea of the omnipresence of God, it's kind of like peanut butter on a sandwich, on a slice of bread. You know, he's kind of spread all over. You know, I take that peanut butter and I spread it all over the bread. That's kind of how God is. He's spread all over. That's not the way God is. Scripture tells us that his whole person is everywhere all at once. Yeah, that blows my mind. Yeah, it blows mine too. Because we don't have anything in this world that even comes close to resembling omnipresence. And it's interesting because as we see in this chapter that God is omnipresent, we can apply this to prayer as well. When you pray, God is not too busy to hear you. Oh, you know, there's a lot going on in the Middle East today. I bet, there's probably Christians in the Middle East that are busy in God right now. He doesn't have time for my request. Nonsense. When we pray to God, we have his whole person. We have all his attention. Isn't that amazing? He's not like peanut butter on bread spread all over the place. No, we have his whole person when we talk to him. When we meet here today, we say God is here. Yes, he is. Just part of him? Maybe it's just his foot that's here. You know, it's just a little bit of God over here. No, we have God's presence with us today. His whole presence, not part of him, not a little bit of him. But that's something that we can apply the omnipresence of God to, is the idea of prayer. And I hope you do. I hope you find encouragement through this to be diligent in your prayer life as a believer. So number one, God's sovereign. Number two, God's not limited by a box or a location. Number three, we cannot manipulate God. Maybe they felt that they could manipulate God, that they could, steal him and he would be their good luck charm and no one could stand up. The Israelites couldn't stand up to the Philistines at this point. They felt that they could manipulate God. Look, we must follow him rather than expecting him to follow us. God isn't manipulated. God isn't impressed by you know, our prayer life. Well, if I don't eat for 3 weeks, I will impress God and he'll answer my prayer. He'll have to. People figure sometimes they're twisting God's arm to answer prayer. That's not true. Remember, he's sovereign. He's in control. He wants us to pray. He wants us to bring our requests to him. But understand, we don't manipulate him. He answers prayer, yes, but we don't manipulate him. We don't twist his arm. We have to follow him rather than expecting him to follow us. Christian, are you? Are you faithfully following God? Are you in his word each day? Are you in prayer, which would reflect an individual who is following God? Are you recognizing that God is sovereign? He's in control. That you don't need to worry about everything in your life because we have a God who's in control. It's okay. And when we pray, we need to realize that God is omnipresent, and hopefully that's an encouragement. But after saying all of this to Christians, let me ask you today, are you a Christian? Do you know for sure that if you died right now that you'd spend eternity with Jesus Christ? And if you're not sure, you don't have to leave here today. You don't have to walk out those doors and say, boy, I sure wish I knew. I sure wish I knew if I died right now I'd go to heaven. You can know. How can you know? The Bible tells us, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Will you believe on him today if you have not? Will you trust him as your Savior from sin? Christian, will you walk with him today if you're not?